So good morning. It's a pleasure to be here this morning. We're here to talk about value-based healthcare decision-making, the quest for smarter spending. My name is Jennifer Snow. I'm with Xcenda Healthcare. Xcenda is a global healthcare market access company that works primarily with pharmaceutical and biotech clients on everything from early stage health economic research to dossiers, to reimbursement strategies and value-based propositions, and then tools for providers. We really do everything that runs the full gamut of life cycle management. And that's kind of why I'm here today. Our job in terms of, you know, being consultants, we've seen so much change over the last 10 years in terms of this quest for value, the quest for smarter spending. And, you know, kind of a little behind the scenes for you guys in the audience, we start planning these panels months in advance, and I got to put together my dream team. So I'm really, really excited today to be able to present the different perspectives in the for the audience from, you know, patients and global HTA and value assessments going on in the U.S. and the pharmaceutical perspective. So this is just super exciting for me. What I did not plan on was having a sinus infection. If I sound a little froggy or if I sneeze, I truly apologize. But this is just really exciting this morning. And so the format for this will be, I'll talk for a few minutes and then we'll each take kind of a turn presenting our perspectives. And then I'll ask everyone a few questions. And then we will have time for audience questions. So if you have anything that you'd want to ask, please come up. I'll open the mics towards the end of our presentation, but there certainly will be time for questions. Let me provide a little bit of context for why we're here today. Obviously, value is not new. I mean, we all pay for value in everything we do. I mean, we make decisions and we make assessments. But why is it coming up today? Why are we here? There's a lot of instability in the healthcare atmosphere. We have so much going on and things being thrown at you and things in the news that we're hearing the word value come up a lot. And that's because we've got a lot of scrutiny of drug pricing. We've got the introduction of biosimilars. We've got 340B pricing kind of making a resurgence in terms of what that's going to look like in the future. We've got, you know, these assessment frameworks. We've got CMS really pushing, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, pushing alternative payment models. We've got value-based contracting coming up. We've got consolidation in the marketplace. So there's a lot of different forces kind of coming together to make this movement towards value even more important, and that's kind of why we're here today. What is value? And that is like it's a terrific question that I'm afraid we're not going to answer today. We're going to answer components of it and get the different perspectives on the stage. But value is what's different today than we've seen in the past is really this notion towards transparency in how people are making these value decisions. We have to factor in clinical value. We have to factor in what as a society we see as value. We have to factor in what patients are seeing, what their satisfaction is, what the outcomes are, and really that balance of cost and quality and as it relates to value. So today's panel is going to lead us through several different vantage points and in efforts to hone in a little bit more on what value is. Again, I don't expect we're going to come away with the answer on what value is, like the one definition, but my hope is that we'll all recognize the components and perspectives and understand the challenges and implications brought on by this new focus on value. And most importantly, I think focus on ways to collaborate between different entities on the stage here and elsewhere to try to come up with, I think, transparent ways that really take into account what is value and how to best proceed. First up, I am going to be turning it over to Dr. Sarah Garner. Sarah Garner is a pharmacist specializing in the interface between health technology assessment and regulation. She is an associate professor for science policy and research at the National Institute for Health and Care Excellence, and an honorary professor at the University College London and Manchester University. She leads work packages of the Get Real and Adapt Smart projects and is funded by the EU Innovative Medicines Initiative. Dr. Garner, the floor is yours.
Okay, thank you very much. So my opening gambit is the conversation of value is not new. It's just new to the US.
And we're behind again.
Yeah, I had the pleasure of living in the US for a year on a Harkness Fellowship. And it was about the time the death panel conversation was happening and socialized medicine and all that furore. So I'm absolutely delighted that the conversation has now changed.
Teach us. Teach us how it's done.
Yeah, and we can actually sort of move forward now with actually constructive conversations about how we actually measure value and how we fund value, because that's where the grown-up conversation needs to be. And at the end of the day, we need to provide incentives for value. We need medicines that will deliver step changes. So if we incentivize that value, that's going to help us, the companies, make those decisions to pull those products through. And I think the healthcare system has a big role in supporting the development of those products. They're very valuable. We all need those new medicines. If they don't come from the pharmaceutical industry, where are they going to come from? So I think we have it's a joint agenda. We have a social responsibility to actually sit down and have that grown-up conversation now and come out from the corners of the room and have it. So it's absolutely great. My second point I want to make is around value being really, really context specific, and this slide represents NICE. We have a fixed tax-funded healthcare system. It's a fixed budget. So the notion of whatever you spend the money on, you then haven't got it available to spend on something else, that is very, very real. We've previously gone into deficits. The current Conservative government is trying to reverse that process. We're under austerity measures. Budgets are really, really tight. So fixed healthcare budgets, a lot of European systems operate more or less in the same way, whereas the US system is very, very different. It's much more fragmented. You have the health insurance, where what I saw was there that actually the costs weren't such an issue because they were displaced, and importantly they were generally tended to be displaced to patients and people getting into massive economic situation debt because they're having to choose between real things and the medicines. And I think that's less visible than it is in a public system. So you have to, when you're setting up a value framework, you have to work within the healthcare system. Nonetheless, there are some really questions that are common, I think. So regardless how you set this process up, and the questions are on the right of this slide, so what are the issues with this particular drug? You know, what does it do? What are we doing for that patient group at the moment? Really, really important context. You know, everybody's receiving something, they're being managed. So what are we doing? And that can be very difficult to establish current practice. It usually quite diverse. What's the difference in costs between the new thing and the old thing? What's the difference in effects? Everything's got pros and cons, so what are they? It could be different side effect profiles, it could be more resources, so if you have an injectable versus an oral, you're going to have more hospital time, more resources in terms of staffing, or it could be on the patient side, you know, more trips to the hospital. So you need to look at it in the round, which is what the modelling exercises do. And then a fixed budget, you need to look at the consequence for all the patients, so not just the patient group in front of you, for the other patients, because you're making decisions about funding one thing versus another thing, which has consequences. And also, you need to maximise the amount of health that you're purchasing for the healthcare system, which is the essence behind the qualities. So you're maximising the amount of qualities you buy. So it has consequences, so you need to scope that out very clearly. And this should happen regardless of your value framework. You need to actually understand the problem you're dealing with. My next point is around the process of decision making. I think there's a perception that NICE has a threshold and it's cut off, and anything that's above it gets funded and anything that's below it doesn't. This slide starts to tease out some of the factors that are included in the decision making process, and as you can see, cost effectiveness is just one component of that. We also look at the clinical effectiveness. We struggle sometimes because we've got regulatory data which is looking at efficacy, whereas actually we want a lot of things that haven't been included in those trials. And so we do modelling again to extrapolate short term to long term. For example, we have input from the clinical experts, the patient experts. There's always uncertainty. We never have sufficient information or exactly the right information that we want. Sometimes these drugs are often very new in the life cycle, so it's very early experience with them. And then there's a lot of legislation around diversity, promoting equality for specific protected patient groups, and something called social value judgments, which is about how we allocate things within society. Do you give greater benefit to children? Do you give more weight to people at the end of life? So there's a range of factors that need to go into it. And the next slide just shows you some of the work we've just been doing with MIT. So if it wasn't complicated enough, we've been back through the catalogue of NICE's technology appraisals and starting to really, really pull out what were the factors that went into the decision making. And you can see it's more than just even what I presented before. There's all these other things that go into the decision-making process. And this is a little bit of a teaser, because as you can see from each one of these, there's more lines going off it. We're still putting the work together, and we'll be publishing it soon. But it very, very quickly gets very, very complicated, those assessments. And the people making the decisions need to be able to grapple with those things. So we're putting in some projects to actually understand about the visibility of how we manage that decision-making process, how we communicate this complexity, and how we actually communicate the uncertainty around different decisions. And then just my last two points very quickly. There's never going to be a right answer about value. There is never a definitive answer. It's not a static, it's a dynamic thing, lots of input, lots of experience. So it's really important you have a good, fair process around the determination of value, the accountability for reasonableness, about inclusiveness and transparency, to give everybody their say and pay attention to the comments you receive. So that is also really, really important. And then just finally, the worrying thing I see about the US dialogue around value, I don't see a simultaneous narrative around affordability happening. We're very, very focusing on value. We're seeing things that are costed for years of treatment avoided, which is the counterfactual alternative scenario. But that is not going to take away from the ability of the healthcare systems to pay. So we need to have that conversation simultaneously, start thinking about new managed access models, new payment models, and generally a bit more transparency over the pricing of pharmaceuticals, so we can actually understand why we've got to these prices in the first place.
Oh, so that's really interesting. When you're saying the word affordability,
yeah,
are you referring to affordability to the system or affordability to the patient?
It will depend on your healthcare system. Either way, yeah, Somebody's paying.
So, because in the U.S., so yeah, That's really interesting, yeah, and I'm getting smiles, so I'm hoping I'm on the right track. So when I hear the word affordability in the U.S., we do not say, you're right, we don't currently say a lot, talk a lot about affordability to the, yeah, system. We talk about affordability as it refers to the patient.
Yeah.
And so that it's an interesting
distinction.
It's got to
be paid for by somebody, whether it's the health insurance plan putting premiums up or tiering and displacing the costs onto patients. Okay. Somebody's got to pay for it. It's just more transparent, I think, in other healthcare systems about who it is that's paying for it.
How transparent is NICE in terms of, you know, it goes through this process. How, yeah, transparent is the process, you know, to a patient or a pharmaceutical manufacturer? Are they able to see, yeah, everything that's going on,
it's,
and understand how the decision is being made?
We have sort of five pillars, if you like, of the decision-making process, which is drawn from the accountability of reasonableness. And one of them is transparency. So at every single part of the system, we consult with stakeholders. We set the question so that the first slide I put up, we start setting the questions. What's the population, the intervention, the comparators? That goes out for consultation. We have a workshop. Everybody's invited to it. We put all the documents on the website. We issue draft guidance. It goes out for comment. People send, okay, comments. Yeah. So it's all fully transparent. I think where we could do better is in the communication of how this morass that we're seeing here actually played out in reality. And that's to do with how we structure our guidance documents. So we're putting in some projects to actually resolve that.
And the other thing that I found striking about your comments was the idea that value is not static. It obviously, yeah, changes over time. How does this process that you're describing here, how often is it revisited? Because, you know, obviously the value, once, you know, a product comes out on the market, it goes through the, you know, clinical, mm-hmm, trials, and there's only so much information that's captured in those. And then, mm-hmm, it's really about the real world and the observational that happens, yeah, later. And then that's oftentimes where the value is truly, you know, or a lot, mm-hmm, different value is kind of captured.
Yes.
How is that factored? How is the later recaptured?
So there's two ways. So each piece of guidance has a sell-by date. So that's when it's automatically reviewed. It's usually every 3, 4, 5 years. But we also renew guidance if there's some significant evidence. The manufacturer might say, you know, we've got some more evidence, we need to look at it again, or something might be published which prompts a review. So that there's mechanisms in place. On the other level, we have something in the European legislation called conditional licensing, and it's very different from the US. It's whereby these are usually medicines for very high unmet need, which go through the process whereby they don't have to provide the whole evidence package up front, and that enables early access. But as part of that, yeah, there's an agreement about what evidence will be provided, and there's dates put on that, and there's conditions on the license that if a full license, you have to meet provide this evidence and meet these criteria, basically. So we're seeing more medicines go down that route, which will, and the difference is we actually plan this. We're now engaging through the adaptive pathways on this, that we can actually plan out what are the downstream stakeholder needs in terms of evidence and make sure we get it on time. And we're really involved in those discussions, and we can influence the development plans very early as the medicines come through. The other bit, I think, as well, that we're doing some work on is Myeloma UK, which is the UK multiple myeloma patient organisation, have just funded me, a post, and my team for 2 years to look at patient preferences as well. And actually, again, this is very missing, I think, from the drug development, and understanding what it is the patients value, right, in terms of outcomes. That needs to be brought in when we're deciding which medicines to actually invest in and develop in the first, sure, place. It needs to be more embedded in the regulatory process, and we need to put it more in the HTA, because we've been relying on procedural commenting, qualitative studies. So we want to see if we can really now start understanding and weighting those benefits for patients. So it's very exploratory, but we're quite excited about that project and hope it's going to again change, develop this paradigm of value.
Thank you. I really appreciate that. So next up, I'd like to introduce Dr. Dick Wilkie, who will tell us more about the work that ISPOR is doing. ISPOR is the International Society for Pharmacoeconomics and Outcomes Research. Dr. Wilkie is Chief Science Officer of ISPOR. He has over 30 years of experience in health economics and outcomes research, including group leadership roles within Pfizer and its legacy companies. At ISPOR, Dr. Wilkie is responsible for strategic initiatives related to the Society's research, scientific, and content priorities. Dr. Wilkie?
Thank you, Jennifer. So first I'm going to ask for a show of hands. How many of you have actually looked at any of the details of the half a dozen or so value frameworks that have been published here in the U.S.? Okay, not a lot. So let me spend a minute on what that's about. For quite a while, we've been aware of doing health economic assessments. ISPOR has published something like 40 task force reports about various, where we've gotten members and other experts together to talk about really good ways of doing health economics and outcomes and cost effectiveness and that kind of thing. More recently, in the last couple or 3 years, about half a dozen U.S. organizations have published very specific guidelines or formulas for how you talk about the value of a given product, perhaps what price it should be. One organization called ICER actually has gone through this exercise, and they come out with a value-based price according to cost effectiveness and affordability criteria. Groups like ASCO look more at patient and as well as cost factors, and they come up with a point system based on various criteria, and that's supposed to help guide a decision. So again, there are various of these frameworks out there now that are meant to guide decisions, and yet they're all different, and they differ in the ways they do their measurements, the way they add them up, the factors they consider. And so as an organization, we felt it was time to start looking at the pros and cons of some of these, or the strengths and weaknesses of some of these frameworks. And from a health economics and outcomes research point of view, how would we recommend you do specific things better? So we started this earlier this year. We started this initiative on value assessment frameworks. And in the large, it's to inform this move that we're seeing towards value-based healthcare. And in specific, we're trying to inform specific value frameworks, which we recognize need to be different depending on the decision-making context, as Sarah was just saying. And so it's not a one-size-fits-all situation, but there are still better ways to do certain things when you're doing these assessments. So that's what we're trying to get at. So we assembled a few people and a large part health economists to think about the methodological aspects of this, but we also are involving a variety of stakeholders. And I should say this is a U.S.-based effort, with all due respect to our British cousins. And we've paid a lot of attention to NICE over the years. We thought, well, we should really think about the U.S. system and how that works.
Remember, we're just starting to have grown-up conversations, yes. Sarah. I was like, hey.
But and we have some international UK-based folks involved, because there are a lot of learnings there. So let me talk a little bit about it. As I said, we thought we'd focus on the methodological issues. There are certainly very important process issues. Health economists may not be the best folks to decide on process. So that's where the stakeholders come in. So we put together an expert advisory board and a stakeholder advisory panel. And I'll show you in a minute how that looks. The idea is to then convene a special task force, which will come out with a white paper and probably, hopefully, eventually a publication that will lay out some of the key methodological issues we think should be observed as people do value frameworks. We're also planning to publish an issue of our journal Value in Health next year, which covers a lot of the topics that are involved in these frameworks. So here's how it looks. We started the steering committee. I'm part of the steering committee. We have a few others. We've gotten some help from pharma here, too. They're very interested in this. And again, the focal point is thinking about the key methodological issues in these value frameworks. So we've gone out with surveys to the stakeholder panel and the expert advisory board around principles in these value frameworks and about their specific evaluations, strengths, limitations of the half a dozen value frameworks that are out there. These all provide input to the special task force. We have recruited these two advisory boards now. That work is in progress. We're putting together a special task force, which will be mainly the health economists, with a lot of input from the surveys that we're doing. Their first task is to come out with a scope of work over the summer. In the fall, then, we are convening a stakeholder conference where we'll lay this out for a broad group of stakeholders, patients, payers, pharma, clinicians, and some other stakeholders. So watch this space. We'll make an announcement at this conference in a week or two. They will take all that input and proceed towards doing a white paper, perhaps, probably with some more consultation before the white paper's finished. The white paper, we hope, will come out middle of next year. Meanwhile, we put out a call for papers for the value and health issue. We got 125 submissions, and so that will result in a full issue on these topics. I think I've covered some of this now, that the expert advisory board is really an all-star cast of health economists. They've been surveyed. We've had one meeting with them to sort of talk about what their view of the key issues were, and so we could sort of start the process towards a scope of work. We've done these surveys. We're in the midst of compiling the stakeholder survey right now. We did have a couple of sessions at the American Society of Health Economics meetings here in Philly just a couple of weeks ago, where we laid out a few things we were interested in and wanted to get feedback from that side. And I mentioned the call of papers. So this is definitely work in progress, and the key events will be a stakeholder conference in the fall, a value and health issue in the early 2017, and then our own white paper recommendations a little bit later in 2017. So I think that's all I have to say for now. Yeah. Thank you for listening, and I hope this is going to be informative, not just for our members, which is our initial audience. They're looking to us for this guidance, and occasionally they listen, but to the broader U.S. audience. So,
well, I've got some questions for you. All not right. Off the hook just yet. Okay. So you began talking about ASCO and NCCN and ESMO, and I mean, we've got a lot of value frameworks out there. And before I forget, I'm going to put a plug out there for the National Pharmaceutical Council. Kimberly yes. Westrich put out a fantastic document kind of summarizing all the different frameworks. And so it's a great cheat sheet so that if you're interested in the topic and want to learn more about them, it's a great way to kind of get all of them in one snapshot and dive in. But you mentioned all the different frameworks. Is your initiative going to be coming up with a new value framework per se? Or, you know, what do you think what's the output?
I don't think so. I don't know that I can control a dozen health economists. No. But I do, it's fundamental to how we look at the world is that value is in the eye of the customer. And so perspective is very important. And I wouldn't expect an ASCO framework to look exactly, or an oncology-related framework to look exactly like something a payer would want to put together, or a CMS would want to put together. But they should have some elements in common, and those elements should be done the same way, or more or less the same way. So that's what we're trying to get at, that we observe certain principles in how the common elements of them are done. Also, your plug for NPC was very good, and I should also mention that while they have not put together a value framework per se, they did put out a set of 30-some guiding principles, which are kind of bite-sized chunks of things that should be thought about in value frameworks. And we've paid a lot of attention to those. We will do deeper dives into some of those bite-sized chunks. So if you want to sort of put these pieces together, that's how they fit.
You know, what's going to be included in your recommendations that are not included in the current value frameworks? You mentioned somewhere how they're the same. How are they going to be different?
We've talked about some of those things. And again, I can't say for sure, but the
but
kinds
you've been
of
so
things we talked about, affordability is definitely an issue. ICER has done it a certain way. I think a lot of people have commented on how they did it, and there may be alternatives, and we'll certainly talk about those. We talk about the less, well, they haven't been well quantified so far, but we think maybe they could. So the value of hope, for example. We've started to understand the patient's value, not just the mean outcome, but so what's the mean survival or median survival for a cancer therapy, but what's the potential for a long-term survival, even if it's only 10 or 20% that doesn't maybe affect the median. So that kind of thing. What's the value of broader coverage, your peace of mind due to broader insurance coverage? Some of these things that are real that we can probably quantify, but they won't be always the same across patients and groups. But they should be thought about and can be thought about in a little bit more systematic way. So these are the kinds of things that have come up and will be discussed, and hopefully there'll be some progress there.
Didn't expect to get emotional during a panel. My dad had been treated at UPenn just down the road, and you're talking about the value of hope, and I'm like, yes, that's true. And so thank you. I wasn't expecting that. I want to switch perspectives, and I think it's a great segue to have Benjamin Haywood tell us more about that patient perspective. As president and director of Patients Like Me, Benjamin Haywood is responsible for setting the company vision to improve healthcare and accelerate research while directing its business growth strategy. Benjamin was inspired by his brother Stephen's battle with ALS, and he co-founded the company in 2004. And I have to say, I think the patient perspective is one that has been overlooked and for a long time, and groups like Patients Like Me have just worked so hard to ensure that the patient voice is heard and counted. I've heard it at IOM and other places, and I've just been so inspired by Patients Like Me and its continued effort to make sure that the patient voice, especially in policy circles, you know, I know on a day-to-day level that the audience probably is not involved in the policy discussions in D.C., but, you know, it is where a lot of kind of behind-the-scenes stuff that happens in the news and everywhere else, it happens, and groups like Patients Like Me have just been really working hard to make sure that Congress and IOM and pharmaceutical companies and you know, HTA organizations all remember to talk about the patient. And so, thank you.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it, and thank you for having us. I think, actually, ironically, I'm on this panel because to your point, Sally Oaken, my colleague, is down meeting with Vice President Biden as part of the Moonshot Initiative. And I think
so. You drew the short end.
Yeah, not sure why. I think I made that choice, which you know.
Hey, look at that, guys! You won.
So,
but I think that actually highlights the importance. You know, they're having a small meeting, and it highlights the importance. And I think the reflects real change in the system in terms of turning and trying to understand that patient voice. I think Richard, you just described something really interesting, which is the value of hope. And actually, you can begin to measure that stuff and do it methodologically. And I think that needs to begin to do. And I'll talk a little bit about that as we go. You know, this is some information from when we look at this, we need to remember, we're talking here a little bit about the clinical spend, right? This $3 trillion U.S. economy, or at least in the case of us. But the reality is what drives health outcomes, that's only about 20% or some, you know, estimates range, but, you know, 20% of what actually drives outcomes. There's a whole part of the patient and the patient's lives that really affect outcomes as significantly. And I think one of the things we really have to think about as we think about this problem, and to your point about context, we need to pull back and actually think about the full context and think about healthcare more broadly, I think, as we do this work. You know, and again, even in the clinical realm, you know, a lot of the dollars are spent on the toughest patients. You know, again, just to thinking about that and understanding that as we think about value. But I'll go to a statement that really, you know, we started Patients Like Me on some level with this goal in mind. I believe fundamentally that patient value should drive the market value of products and services. I am a capitalist despite running a company that I think is a mission-driven company. And I think to do that starts with measuring and understanding patient value and doing it scientifically and at scale. And that begins to, that incorporates things like Richard talked about, you know, understanding and capturing things like the value of hope or understanding the concepts of thriving and what that means. And, you know, a great example is my brother who was dying of a terminal illness but was probably one of the healthier people because he was eating this goop through a feeding tube and was exercising despite having ALS every day. And so and actually rebuilt a carriage house outside of the back of my brother's house, all while being on a wheelchair, on a vent, talking through a computer. And so what does that mean? What does thriving mean in the context of illness? And I think we do this, we have to really think about it. Now, we talked a little bit, and this is often described as a multi-stakeholder problem. I find that an odd thing. I feel like this is a one-stakeholder problem. I mean, the healthcare system should be about patients and only patients. The other stakeholders have an interest, but I think fundamentally we need to start, and even the framing of a multi-stakeholder problem, which ultimately as you're redesigning the system, it is, but I think even that framing tends to undervalue the importance of focusing on patients, both individually and as a group. So for those of you guys who don't know patients like me, we've really, for the last 10 years, for 12 years now, gone directly to patients and helped them and encouraged them to measure and understand their illness directly, sort of through patient-generated health data. And through the time, we've developed a number of measurement principles, some of them starting with a lot of the PRO development measurement principles, which really do take into account patient concepts and patient input and is actually quite rigorous a methodology to understand. And we've developed and expanded those to how we think about designing the site. And I think there's things in here that we can take as we expand it. And I'll talk a little bit about the work we're doing now with Robert Johnson. But, again, make measurement clear and answerable for patients, efficient. Efficiency is a big one, right? I mean, for those of you guys in the PRO realm, we're not going to be able to have 1,000 PROs for a patient with multiple chronic conditions and do that in a real way. We're going to have to think about how to efficiently and quickly measure that. Again, engaging patients in measuring and understanding their health is an opportunity for education and helping them understand what's important and engaging them around what's important both to the system and patients. And then on the other side, just some design principles. I mean, I think minimize my work, put my needs first. Again, this is all about sort of thinking about this sort of patient-centered. And again, this is our methodology that we've developed through being in the homes of patients, understanding their patient journey, seeing the collective and the similar set of questions that patients get unanswered from the system today. So that goes to a project we're doing now, which I'm really excited about, which is taking a lot of our work in patient-reported outcome development and patient-generated health data and moving that into the performance measurement space, which is, again, understanding and how the system gets paid. And we're doing this with the National Quality Forum and through their incubator and funded by Robert Wood Johnson. And we're really trying to, again, take the patient input, the methodologies that we've adapted and developed and apply those to the performance measurement space, which actually surprisingly is a really rigorous space from a measurement design and understanding standpoint, but is actually quite immature when it comes to patient input on some level relative to, for example, the FDA PRO process. And I mean, just as an example, I was talking to a very successful, well-regarded measure developer, and they're working on a new PRO performance measurement, and they're like, we'll have a patient as part of our process. It's they'll be part of our expert panel. They may not have the condition we're working on, but they'll be a patient.
It'll and be I'm a like, patient.
So you're going to have eight deep clinical experts in one patient that may or may not understand the disease you're talking about. That's not the same as traditional PRO development, where you're really starting with the patient and understanding it. So, we're pulling back and again to thinking about the whole patient and starting afresh and saying, hey, what does good care look like to patients, and asking them and understanding. How do they define that? And I think two subsets, which I think are really interesting that we're going to be looking at is, how do patients view the shared accountability, right? I mean, what is the responsibility of the clinician around performance if a lot of it's in the hands of the patient, and how do patients view that? Sure. And then lastly, I don't think anyone's ever asked or really in a large way talked to patients about, how do you think the system should get paid? Let's really redesign the system with the patients. And we're really excited about that work. We're just embarking on some of the bottom of this, and we're also going to be working with some measure developers to expand the way they bring patient input into it. And again, I think this goes to what Richard talked about. I think we can apply a lot of the really rigorous methods of getting patient input that are done in very small parts of the healthcare system, PRO development, other places. And I think we can bring those to harder concepts that I think then we can bring into the system and make it much better as we're thinking about the value problem.
I really like that. Help me capture my truth. I think it's a great way of framing it. And I think the accountability question is a great one, because obviously my provider can't be responsible for whether I well, they are responsible for whether I take my medicine or not, but they're not with me when I realize I didn't have my water next to me. You know, I forgot to pack my water and I don't have it. And so what, do I take my medicine or not? And so it's an interesting quandary. So Ben, how can technology and other patient-oriented tools, such as patients like me, help patients evaluate if what they value is part of their provider's care delivery?
You know, it's interesting. What I see, I think, is interesting right now, and I really do think we're on a really interesting, a really sea change time. You know, one, people often ask and try and struggle with why the internet hasn't come to healthcare, right? You know, it's transformed over any other industry and system. And I think it's because the predominant operating system on which healthcare is done is the EMR. And that's sort of like saying, why isn't the internet in 1981 using MS-DOS transformed the system? And what I see possible in the next little bit here is that the information technology and patient measurement and biological measurement is going to explode so fast that we can extract that information technology to the individual patient or a proxy of the individual patient, like patients like me or some other solution, to measure and understand the patient both deeply biologically, rigorously around patient preferences and things like hope and thriving and other issues that sort of expand the healthcare system, and that we can begin to expect that any intervention the system provides, and whether that's a drug or office visit or whatever, demonstrates real movement on value on all of those attributes. And I think, you know, we're not there yet, but I think the technology and direct-to-patient will enable that. And I actually think it'll get to a potential individual level value judgment. I mean, to your point about evolving, I'm not sure. I mean, obviously there will always be cohorts, but I think at some point in time we can get this down to a very, very acute individualized framework. And I think what I'm excited about is I think the technology is just, both the information technology, the biological measurement technology, they're just about to all come together in a way that we can really actually start afresh as we think about the system for measurement.
So with great power comes great responsibility.
Yeah.
So what's the responsibility and the role of patients and their caregivers in these value-based payment models?
I mean, obviously in the U.S., more and more of the direct dollar responsibility is being driven to them. Sure. So, I mean, I think they're just going to demand more and more information, demand transparency. I think some of the challenges of the value-based, some of the challenge of the dialogue around value-based is it's sort of moving what we used to do with managed care, where we could blame evil bureaucrats for making these terrible decisions, and now we're making that in the hands of the provider. And what I'm a little worried about is that we are going to break down one of the things, the fabrics that I think really make the system work, which is the patient-provider trust framework. And if providers are making fiduciarily driven value decisions and they become the evil bureaucrats in this new world, that's a problem. And I think it'll break down that, it could break down that trust. And I think the things that fix that are transparency. I think you touched on that, understanding that. And again, I think focusing on the patient ultimately fixes that as well. But I think there is some potential for real challenges there.
Thank you. I really appreciate that. So next up, we have Noel McAlee. You know, the phrase last but not least often gets used. And I'd like to say that we definitely saved the best for last. No offense, the rest of them. I fangirled Noel last month, I have to confess. I was at a conference, and I knew he was going to be up here. And I had met Noel a while back, and I was like, I wanted to say hello, and so I stalked him in a lobby of a hotel, and he was very gracious about it. And so I'm so honored that he's here to provide us with the pharmaceutical twist to the value conversation. Newell is an AVP of Market Partners in the Center for Observational and RWE at Merck. He currently works on ensuring payer and HTA agency-informed research plans. He conducts collaborative research with customers, developing strategic partnerships with research institutions, and conducts health policy research. In addition, he currently has an active role on several boards and committees, including the AMCP Foundation Board of Directors, the AMCP Format Executive Committee, the ICER Advisory Board, and the IOM Roundtable on the Promotion of Health Equity and Elimination of Health Disparities. That's
enough.
Too much?
Enough.
Enough?
Enough.
Yeah. We can keep talking about you. No? Okay.
Enough.
Floor is yours.
So thank you, Jennifer. It's really a pleasure for me to be here this morning, and I'll try to build on some of the themes that I've heard from the other panelists here. But I want to start with just some terminology just to make sure we're sort of grounded and talking about the same thing. So you've heard a lot this morning about value, And, you know, I think Warren Buffett said, price is what you pay and value is what you get. But value is really whether something is worth doing. And it's always in the eye of the beholder. And so, you know, there are a lot of different perspectives on value. I think Ben got it right. It really should be value for patients. Michael Porter started publishing on this, 10 years ago, Ben, something like that, and from Harvard Business School. And if you focus on value for patients, I think everyone can rally around that. I, with all due respect to Sarah, I think we have been thinking about value for a longer time in the U.S. than many people believe, because P&T committees and health systems have been thinking about value for a long time. It just doesn't get out in the public domain. There's not a lot of public debate about it. We've been using in the U.S. the AMCP dossier to submit information to health systems and payers since about 1997, 1998. So I think pharmaceutical companies have been submitting information. A lot of the large, sophisticated health plans have been using information about value for a long time. But if you listen to the politicians, then, you know, we don't do value assessments in the U.S. So we also take a look at budget impact, because health systems are worried about, you know, it's a fragmented system in general in the U.S., but even within a particular health system, the pharmacy budget is different from the medical budget, and so the pharmacists want to know, so what is this going to do to my pharmacy budget next year? So we have to put in information about budget impact. But my main point that I want to make is that it's something that you've heard from some of the other panelists, is that I think we're moving towards affordability being a bigger issue than value. And this is because, at least when I talk to senior executives in health plans, what they say is, you guys have 600 gene therapies in development, and they're all going to be coming to market in the next 3 to 5 years. We're already in survival mode, and we're going to go out of business. So from a health system perspective, there is really a lot of concern about the cost of all these new therapies coming to market in the next 3 to 5 years. So the issue of can we afford to do it is really important, and that's what I want to spend the remainder of my time talking about is affordability. So I grew up in one of the 10 poorest counties, or I grew up in Louisiana, so we call them parishes, one of the 10 poorest counties in the U.S., right where Louisiana, Mississippi, and Arkansas come together. And I can assure you, people, even when I was a kid, were making trade-offs between food, housing, healthcare. So affordability has been an issue for some segments of the population forever. But within the past couple of years, it's become a major issue for a much larger portion of the U.S., primarily because of, probably triggered by, developments of cures that are coming to market, whether it's in hepatitis C or oncology or whatever. And these cures pose some particular challenges to the healthcare system, because all of the costs are, in many cases, the costs are front-loaded and the benefits occur sometime in the future. Now, that's a real problem if you've got a fragmented health system. So imagine, you know, a 60-year-old patient with hepatitis C in a commercial health plan that is going to be going to a Medicare system at 65, there's not a lot of incentive for that health plan to invest hundreds of thousands of dollars into a treatment if the benefit is going to occur when that patient moves to Medicare. And within the U.S. healthcare system, you know, as many of you know that have employer-based healthcare, people move systems all the time, go from one plan to the next. Some people may go in and out of Medicaid and then ultimately into Medicare. So it's a real challenge, and there are some solutions that have been proposed for this. They're all sort of ideas at the moment. So for example, development of consumer credit markets has been proposed by some well-known economists at MIT and University of Chicago. There is something called HealthCoin that is a sort of analog to Bitcoin, where the future benefit follows a patient, and so each health plan that is accepting a new patient has to pay the previous health system for that future benefit. So there are some mechanisms to deal with that, but there is also an overall budget impact issue. This past week, I saw a YouTube clip of Marilyn Tavener, who was the former CMS, head of CMS, and now she's the CEO of AHIP. She was asked the question, what the future challenges are for health plans in the U.S., and she said there are three. The first is affordability, the second is affordability, and the third is affordability. And so I think, you know, health systems are really concerned about their ability to have a financially stable and sustainable health system. I think the solutions that you hear about affordability really depend on what the goal is. So a lot of the solutions that you hear, for example, even with the ICER framework, is a short-term solution of, so how do we deal with next year's budget? And that takes you down one path. There are sort of medium-term solutions. So there was a paper in New England Journal by Rena Conti, I think this past February, where she said, you know, with all the hoopla in the election year this year, there's not much that's going to happen that gets passed through Congress, but three things may actually happen. One is 340B reform for hospitals. Two is legislation to prevent these dramatic increases in generic drug prices that we're seeing. And three is enhancements to adoption of value-based health insurance, value-based insurance design. For long term, this is really, I think, what our challenge is, to develop this financially stable and sustainable healthcare system. I think it's going to require all of the sectors to come together, to work together. Each sector is probably going to have to compromise to make this happen. The assumptions to doing this are that, one, our current healthcare system in the U.S. is inefficient. The studies that have been done looking at waste in the healthcare system in the U.S. show that consistently there's between 30% and 40% waste. I think the latest paper that I've seen actually by the government investigators in health affairs was 34%. They're all pretty consistent. This inefficiency also makes it difficult to really think about sophisticated techniques to evaluate things coming into the system based on value when you've got a lot of things already in the system that are not very good value and that are actually wasteful. The second thing is just our need to balance both innovation and affordability. If you were just tackling one of those, it would be pretty easy, but to do both of them make it really very difficult. So I think I will stop there. I know you've probably got some very hard questions for me.
It was your bio that you sent me a revised bio last night, and that was what actually triggered one of my questions. So I love the fact that, you know, one of your tasks is to conduct collaborative research with customers. What does that mean? From a pharmaceutical perspective, so I say that because I used to work for a pharmaceutical company. And I love that your role exists, because it acknowledges that there is this need for observational and RWE and to collaborate with other entities. And it is ahead. I don't know, you know, everyone in the audience where you work and what you do, but to me it feels ahead of the curve. And so it's really cool.
Well, I'm not so sure that it's cool. Ahead of the curve. I think a lot of companies are starting to do this.
They're starting to, but I don't know if it's at the center.
From my perspective, the main issue is that our customers often don't trust us, mm-hmm. especially when we, you know, develop models in the back room and we take a model that is not very transparent. And that, you know, so to the extent that we can sit down with them and say, what evidence do you need to inform your decision, and work with them to generate that evidence, then they're much more likely to believe it.
I think that's a great point. I think as we look at all of these issues, I think that be able to start to build that trust and that collaboration, I think, is key. Ben mentioned he's a capitalist, and we've talked about kind of the reality of the situation that we're in now. We do, you know, we're ready for these grown-up conversations. We are a capitalist society. You know, what are the key barriers that we have to overcome in order to create a financially stable and sustainable healthcare system in the U.S.? Because I mean, we have the reality of what's in front of us. Why aren't we there?
Yeah. So it's this concept of getting waste out of the system, I think, that is really, really difficult. It's, we call it disinvestment. But I can give you an example of some things that have happened in the U.S. I think we've done a pretty good job of identifying where the waste is. So there is a project called Choosing Wisely that was, it was run by, I think, the American Board of Internal Medicine Foundation, maybe, Dan Wolfson. And so they went to 30 medical societies and said to the medical societies, can you guys identify five things that are low value that you should stop doing? So the first thing that happened was that some of the medical societies had to come like kicking and screaming. They didn't really want to do this project. But, they finally got around the table and they identified five things that other people should stop doing, not that they should stop doing. So, you see how difficult this is. So then Anthem Health Plan decided to look at implementation of Choosing Wisely. So they picked five low-value things that they thought they should stop doing. They did a sort of pre-evaluation to see what the, what the usage rate was of these five things, two of which involved drugs. And then they had an intervention to get people to stop, and they looked at sort of post what happened. Of the seven things, I think two of them actually went up in use after the post. Two of them went down, and the others were not changed at all. And my point here is that getting waste out of the system is really, really hard. And I don't think we've spent enough time trying to figure out how to do that. So I think that's really the challenge of, I don't know if in the NHS, if you have good examples of being able to do that, but it is really hard.
So that's what, actually, I'm going to ask the panel some questions. But Sarah, as you're hearing, the different perspectives on stage, and what's happening in the U.S., what advice do you have for us? You've kind of been there and done that. Obviously it's a different system, but do you have any kind of words of wisdom for us? How do we start to incorporate value? Are we getting right? What are we not?
I think the first step is having the conversation.
Okay.
For me, it's always having that conversation. Everybody's got skin in the game. And just to have that grown-up conversation and joint conversation about how we tackle that. And it is, says everybody's got to give in this if we're going to fix it. And I think it's, we do just see the political distortion of the messages and the reality. And I think that is one of the barriers. The newspapers are another barrier for it, how they sort of polarise and like to portray people as, good and evil. And it's much more complex than that.
One word that has not come up, and I'm going to open it up to the panel, anyone who's up for it, but the role of innovation has not necessarily been discussed on the panel by anyone. And we talk about affordability and we talk about, the need to manage costs, but what is the value of innovation and does it have a role in these frameworks?
So let me talk about one aspect of that.
Yeah, please.
And one we've talked about is, we think about the context, the concept of externalities. Mm-hmm. So things that, in the broad sense, something your neighbor does that affects you. So they played their music real loud. Well, if you don't like the music, that's a bad thing. Or maybe they feed their birds, and then they bring a lot of songbirds around, and you get the positive value of the bird songs. So positive, negative externalities. Well, one of the things the industry does is create new molecules that become tests of concepts, of do things work? And those inform future development. We call them scientific spillovers. And that feeds into this value of hope. Will there be a new drug if I live another 2 or 3 years? Will that be long enough for a new drug or other treatment to come out that will make the difference? So how do you capture this externality of one treatment bringing knowledge that helps bring another treatment to market? And that's a tough one, but it's a real one. And so that's one of the things the health economists have talked about. And I don't know if we'll do a really good job because it's a tough concept, but those are things you have to think about here. And there is a value to patients, even though it's maybe a step or two down the road, but you don't want to ignore the role of scientific progress and how each step along the way contributes to that.
Okay, the issue I see with all of this is that we're trying to pay for this innovation out of the healthcare system budgets. The healthcare system budgets are there to provide health. That's what it's funded for, why it's allocated. Mm. And the problem is we're trying to run everything through those very, very under pressure budgets. So we need to find a way of splitting the incentives around scientific discovery, which is what you were talking about, I think, versus, you know, commercial choices about which products to bring through, which assets are most valuable. And a lot of those are commercially driven decisions. And we can support that by de-risking some of that process, by working with companies to support those products through, maybe make it less risky, more commercially attractive, because I think that's where a lot of the benefits will be. So take-home message is we need to think about how we incentivize innovation, and I think unless we start taking it out of so incentivizing other ways apart from healthcare system budgets, we're going to keep running into this problem.
I mean, I think, you know, one of the problems that I think we don't focus on enough, and I think innovation is a key, it can be a real key to this, and it's one of the, I would say, focusing memes of our company, is I think the variable on which we should be optimizing is the time to know an intervention works for the system, whether that's in discovery, whether that's in care, whether it's in the real world, because it's that gap in when you do an intervention or you're trying something and then you're testing and validating it works, whether again in real world or discovery realm or clinical realm, preclinical realm, that adds cost because it makes it more difficult to replicate it, you know, just the time on therapy, all these things. And so I think, again, I see an opportunity for innovation to really accelerate that time to know. And you know, if we as a system optimized a little bit better to that, I think we would see really amazing downstream effects in terms of investment in both new innovations as well as actually, I think, eliminating waste and other things.
You know, one thing that we began to talk about was the idea of collaboration. How can different entities, how can patients, you know, collaborate with manufacturers, how can ISPOR do more collaboration? Are there opportunities there that are not being explored?
We can always do better.
Sure.
You know, I think of building a framework as kind of like building a house. One of my kids is an architect. And so you're building a house for its living spaces, for its family space, for its materials, its appealing materials. You also need to adhere to certain architectural standards. So there are some technical details that the architects worry about, but ultimately that all has to fit into a structure that works for the family. And so that consultation needs to take place in a lot of areas, just as you are when you're designing and building a house. Every now and then, the architect or the builder has to go in the back room and say, okay, how do I make sure the house doesn't fall apart? But if you ever build a house, the best way to do it is with a lot of back and forth at different parts of the process. So I think that's what we have to think about as we do this. Where's the best point for that set of points for that involvement?
Yeah, I mean, I would say, look, we've been doing this for 12 years. We've been working with pharmaceutical industry basically since 2008, primarily because I think, you know, they're the ones who are most invested in investing in innovations and evidence in terms of thinking about that problem, primarily because that's how their products get to market. But I would say, so, you know, I think pharma was an early adopter in thinking about it, and even in the 6-8 years we've been working with pharma, I'd say, you know, went from individual thought leaders to companies that were a little bit more thought leaders. Now I think almost everyone's in the mix really trying to understand, you know, obviously in varying levels of investment about how to understand this problem. I would say more broadly, I would say in the last year and a half, 2 years, I would say providers, regulatory, plug for a panel this afternoon I'm running, talking about our FDA research collaboration,
four o'clock.
But I really trying to understand, the patient voice, patient generated health data, understand what that really means and how that can affect the system. Again, even the Rob Roy Johnson thing I mentioned, National Polyform. I think, you know, really, I would say there's been acceleration of understanding and thinking about patient value broadly across the system, and I think it will have real effects. So I'm actually very hopeful in terms of that. And again, it's been the ripple effect across the system that I think is important.
So we're going to go ahead and open up. If anyone has any questions, there's mics in the front. In the meantime, I'm going to ask one more question of the group as any questions come up in the audience. You know, what does all this mean for the clinical development process? We have an audience of people who are, you know, deeply involved in that. And how can manufacturers, if you were advising a manufacturer, how could they plan for this kind of evolving space? Yes. Anyone? Well, maybe anyone has advice for Noel.
Well, in I just talk on an EU level, we've been working on the Adaptive Pathways pilot, which is again this collaborative approach to thinking about drug development, and we've been holding safe harbour conversations.
Oh yeah.
So the concept originated with the New Digs work, and basically you get all the stakeholders in the room right at the start, and discuss the molecule, discuss the disease, discuss again what the patients want out of this, and try to get a better 360-degree picture of what actually the endpoint is, so you get that shared endpoint, because at the moment those discussions happen way too late in the development process, and then at least you can, so from HTA, speak from HTA perspective, the manufacturer gets a very clear understanding of what evidence is likely to be needed, and so they're prepared, ready, and it's not, the issues are not then about the evidence, which is preventable.
I think we're still very early in the process of sort of rethinking how drug development is done.
Yeah.
The incentives in most companies are still surrounding filings, not necessarily even approvals, but filings. And I think now we're starting to bring back into development focus on incentives for payers for adoption and diffusion, and focus on patients. But I think we're still pretty early in that, in that process.
I see a lot of siloed working within companies. That things are very phased and they've got a set sequence that companies are used to working through, and things tend to be just sort of thrown over the wall to the next team, whereas actually if those silos were broken down internally and had that discussion internally, I think there'd be progress as well.
And the process that Sarah was mentioning earlier about adaptive pathways, I think is relatively new thinking for people, but I think has a lot of potential to it's like adaptive licensing. So adaptive reimbursement, you're starting with a small population with a lower price, and as you generate more information, then the population and the price go up. And, that's a model that has never been, it's never been used.
Yeah, I mean, I, just in terms of optimism, I mean, I think thinking about our experience 8 years ago, the PRO people at Pharma were meeting the early discovery people for the first time in the room with us.
Yeah.
I think now we're seeing that the people thinking about performance measurement and value in the real world meeting earlier, just in terms of early signs, I think of it. I think the challenge will be, and I think this is an important that we keep in mind, is that historically, measurement for the label and for the approval has been very focused around, that specific asset and that intervention. And rethinking that to, hey, how do we create a system that measures what matters and then measure that in our discovery and validation framework is a very different thing, because it's hard to let go of, I want to differentially measure to make my asset look better, as opposed to figuring out how to measure globally and then see how your asset does in that framework. And I think that's a very different thought process and mindset. And I think it's challenging for companies to change, because it goes from I own and this is all me to let's think about the system holistically. Yeah. And then we have to win in that fair playing field. And cultural shift.
Yeah, it ties, to the point of where the incentives are for, filings and approvals versus, making sure early on that the quality measure, the things that are being measured are accounted for early on and not just, post. I mean, I've seen it myself with, working on quality measures and what data you have. And it's like, well, we have 1 year data. It's like, no, I need 30 data.
Yeah, I mean, the biggest innovation challenge, I think, for pharma is that these are problems that need to be solved for a company portfolio. But if I'm an individual asset owner, I'm not going I don't want to experiment on the success or failure of my asset within pharma. And so it's a very challenging problem, I think, for the leadership of these companies, because it's a portfolio problem, but you need to test it on an individual asset, and that's not so easy.
And no one is raising their hand.
No one's raising their hands.
Which is where I see some of maybe those products that actually have been too risky to bring through understandard routes. That's where the conversation needs to start, because if they're not going to be brought through anyway, there's no risk for the company.
Yeah.
So that maybe you don't do it on the crown jewels.
Well, we have a question with the mic.
Yes, hi, I'm Eva Finney. I'm in the project management group at Merck. I would like to ask the panel a question about cost in the system. One of the earlier slides had an equation that defined value as quality divided by cost. And earlier there was a discussion about affordability, both from the perspective of the patient and the system overall. And my question specifically is, do we actually know what the cost is for a given procedure? As an example, a year or two ago, I was trying to help my father decide whether or not he should have a certain heart procedure done. And part of the equation that we were going through as a family is, how much is this going to cost out of pocket for my parents, being retired, having limited income? And no one could tell us what that procedure was ultimately going to cost to my father, not even the insurance company. So if you talk to the doctor would say you have to ask the insurance company, you've talked to the hospital. No one could tell what the ultimate cost would be. Even the insurance company didn't know what the cost was going to be. So how can we have a sensible conversation about value if we don't even know what something costs?
I mean, it's an excellent question, and certainly one that I think all of us have probably experienced on a personal level as well.
So I'll start.
Please.
It's a problem that I've personally run into this problem as well. It's hard to find cost within the system, but I can assure you within sophisticated health systems, someone knows that cost. So last week I was here in the same place giving a talk for the Society of Actuaries, very exciting meeting here in Philadelphia. And the actuaries know what the costs are. I can assure you they know what the costs are. Now, there is a transparency issue of whether they're willing to share that information within health systems, because a lot of that they consider sort of proprietary and competitive information. So they don't want their competitors to know what their costs are. So that, you know, so there are a lot of issues in getting that information out there. But I agree with you on the problem of patients themselves being able to figure out what the costs are and compare plans. It's a challenge.
I went through that exact same thing on a minor surgical procedure I had, and that was so frustrating. I mean, I think this relates to some things we can do a little bit more at the policy level. I mean, I think to your point, people somewhere in the system, they know the exact cost. I think insurance companies, my frustration was with them, is they ultimately knew, even if it was just an estimate, because they have, you know, they know customary and acceptable for their areas, right, or whatever that cost pricing model. So they could estimate it for you, but they wouldn't, you know, they would push it back to the provider. And I think transparency to those, full transparency to that, I think will really open up, and it will actually open up all of the absurdity of pricing, you know, when you look at the rack rate at hospitals and other things like that, that just don't fly. And I think Sunshine is going to be one of the best things to that realm. And I'm hoping, although it sometimes feels like you're tilting at windmills as a patient, that the patient pressure will drive that faster than it has today.
Yeah, and I don't know if anyone saw this, but a year or two ago, there was an expose in Time Magazine by one of the writers, Stephen Brill, where they went around and tried to find prices. It was really very interesting.
Any other questions?
Excellent question. Yeah.
Thank you.
With that, I really do. I want to thank the panel. I have truly appreciated your attention this morning, and thank you to all of you for hanging in there. I know that there are a lot of events, late night events, during this week, and so these are the troopers who are here at 8 a.m., so thank you very much.
Thank you.
Enjoy the rest of your day.